sounds a little like a bird. Matt Litton tells us, the opening lines of the novel are so familiar now, but I can still remember the first time they were read to me. When he was nearly 13, my brother Jem got his arm badly broken at the elbow. It seems that I was nearly 13 myself, huddled uncomfortably in the back seat of the family station wagon with my brother and sister, listening intently as the sun burned down on the windshield mural of red clay, bright chrome bumpers, and the green exit signs of that big American highway careening by. When it healed and Jem's fears of never being able to play football were assuaged, the three of us leaned forward toward the front passenger seat, crowded and awkward, like turtles stretching our necks, straining to hear over the rhythmic drone of the rubber sailing on the hot Georgia asphalt. It began the summer Dill came to us, when Dill first gave us the idea of making Boo Radley come out. Our mother, an English teacher, delivered the beautiful compilation of Americana and Grace that is To Kill a Mockingbird, with splendid drama and nuance, as if the car were her classroom, that long vacation drive to the beach. And as is the case with all of the finest novels, every character seemed familiar, every street seemed a real street, every building like some place I had seen before. Although there was much I did not understand about the story on that first read, every word seemed authentic, palpable, and deeply affecting. I was moved by the courage of the protagonists, stunned by the childlike honesty of Scout Finch, horrified by the evil hidden in the hearts of even the good church-going folks, and devastated by the injustice done to Tom Robinson. Although I could never have articulated it at the time, I was introduced to both the beauty and the sickness that resides in the heart of humanity. It was genuine, candid, and so truly an American story. Only with maturity did I begin to appreciate the power of the novel's delicate blend of nostalgia and humor, conveyed with such charm and subtlety that I couldn't help but be disarmed. Only then, with all my defenses down, did I realize that I was being gently forced to look in a mirror, to examine my own life and community, and unequivocally take note of the beauty, the blemishes, and the pressing need for change. Words of Matt Litton in The Mockingbird Parables, reflecting on To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. Litton uses the image of a mirror here to suggest that encountering this story is like being gently made to look in a mirror at his own life and that of his community. And we're being invited to a theatrical production of that story, which in its own way draws us in front of and then through the looking glass, the mirror, not in the Alice in Wonderland sense, but in the sense of self-reflection, a self-conscious way. The Marywood University Department of Music, Theater, and Dance will present To Kill a Mockingbird this Friday and Saturday at the Set La Verghetta Center on the campus in Scranton, under the direction of Charles Gordon, associate professor and theater program director there. Chuck Gordon has extensive experience as a director, and in his first visit to WVIA, he talked with us about his vision for the production and his lifelong love of theater.
I had dreams of, you know, Major League Baseball when I was a youngster, actually, but that got sidelined in college when I got injured, and so that kind of stopped that. And then I actually picked up theater like a lot of young men. It was a way to meet girls. So that's kind of how things evolved for me. And then I was very fortunate. I fell in with a college program, small private college, Park College at that time, now Park University, outside of Kansas City. And there was a transition in leadership there. These professional actors from Missouri Repertory Theater came in and said, well, we have our Master of Fine Arts degrees and we can teach theater. And so they did. They took over the program. And I literally had I had one consistent chair of theater for the 4 years that I was there. But I had different acting professors almost every semester because it was whoever came in with the professional company. And I was also lucky because I just happened to be there. I was ready to get out and go, no, I'm done. I want to leave and go to the West Coast and, you know, pursue my career. And all of a sudden, the Missouri Arts Council, which was a regional organization, had a grant to bring in a guest artist. And that guest artist happened to be Charles Bourdon, who was the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of No Place to Be Somebody, and he was coming in to direct a play by another playwright that he wanted to premiere, and said, I want to use college students to develop it. And so I guess I'm not going to the West Coast as soon as I thought. And so I just stuck around. And, you know, again, I took classes that I never went to that semester because I was too busy attaching myself to Mr. Gordon, which is what I did. And I'm so glad I did, because it really changed my entire life, and I learned so much in just the course of a brief semester. So I've been hooked on theater ever since. I was a professional actor, a member of Actors Equity Association, as well as Screen Actors Guild. I've been in supporting roles, minor roles, in like 5 motion pictures. But I also did a lot of theater work, traveling pretty much all over the country. I worked in Los Angeles, as well as working at in Kansas City, working at the Unicorn Theater there and Missouri Repertory Theater there. Did some work in Chicago, touring companies out of there. An old, old company known as the National Shakespeare Company at that time. They don't even exist anymore. But yeah, I mean, it was a great experience until I decided in my late 20s, close to early 30s, I went, I don't like living on school buses and motel rooms. And I went, no, I don't think so. So I went back to Kansas City, sort of based myself there, worked a lot with Unicorn Theater, and then hooked up with a couple of organizations that were fledgling organizations who wanted an artistic director. And I became artistic director for a company called Actors Ensemble that I was artistic director for a number of years. And then when Michelle and I got married sometime later, my wife, we started a company called Gypsy Theater, and I was the artistic director for that company. And I liked that one probably the best, because we did one acts is what we did, and we did them on dark nights for professional theater. So it worked out. I could still do acting work and directing work freelance for other companies, and yet have this other company that we just did Monday nights. And it was like, it was really fun. But then, yeah, we had children. It was like, all of a sudden, the gypsy lifestyle of doing theater and, you know, being in one town to the next, it kind of lost a little bit of the romance, and I went, well, it's time to think about something else. So I went back to school and got my MFA at the University of Oklahoma, and then I took teaching jobs at University of Arkansas, where I was head of the MFA directing program there for 7 years, and then I took a job at the University of Texas at El Paso, and I was an associate professor and the production coordinator for that program for 10 years. And then, yeah, I saw the job opening at Marywood, and it worked out.
It's wonderful for the students to have someone who's immersed himself in the range of theatrical experience.
Sure, and you know, we encourage also for other people to come in. I mean, it's why Marywood's always open auditions for our productions, because we get people with a broad range of experiences, you know, and having that experience of students interacting with people from the community who also have professional experience at theaters, in some cases in New York, in some cases other places around the country. No, it's great for them, you know, and that's how I learned, and I'm like, well, I want to share that.
When the decision was made to do To Kill a Mockingbird, did it have to do with Harper Lee and all of that?
Some. I mean, quite honestly, you know, it was unfortunate that she passed away and that we lost her. You know, and I felt that deeply because I was very moved by this book as a young child, as I'm sure many Americans were. Most, I would probably say, certainly in my generation. And so, yeah, I went, well, you know, when we were thinking about a play for next year, actually my wife brought it up. She said, well, what about Mockingbird? And I went, yeah, what about it? Because I'd done it some 20 years ago as an actor. I was actually in a production of it. And I went, you know, it might well be a good idea to do that show. And then with the development of things, certainly in our culture, the resurgence of the divisiveness that we've seen in the political scene, certainly, as well as just our everyday lives, it seemed like, why not? This seems like a very pertinent show to do right now at this point in our history.
And to have that 2-decade sense of then and now.
Oh, yes. There's a certain different resonance now, I think, than there was then. I mean, the play certainly is almost archetypical in some ways now, because it is such a part of our lives from the time we're in high school. And I know generations of high school students who've read it over the years. In some cases, it's even being introduced in middle schools now in certain parts of the country. It's that much part of the fabric, I think, of who we are as Americans. And it's something we own. I mean, it's nice to have a piece of American literature like that, that we go, this is ours. And it certainly speaks to not just our strengths as a people, but I think also, and it addresses some of the warts, as it were, that we have in our culture, and says, here's what growing up really is in this country, and kind of what it is to be an American when you start thinking about it. So given that, I went, yeah, this seems like a really not just timely play to do, but I think it's always relevant. It's just, it's a different relevance, I think, today than it was when I did it 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we actually, well, we didn't tour the show, but we had touring groups of students coming from schools to see it. And it was very interesting. I mean, we had school children from predominantly African-American schools that were coming in to see the show. And I had, I guess, the misfortune at the time of playing the bad guy in the show. I was Bob Yule at the time. And, yeah, it was very, very odd to hear the children's reactions, and they were so strong. But I went, it was very vibrant, and it was fun as a performer to go, they're excited by the show, you know, I mean, and they have to hate me to enjoy the show. So it was an odd position, but at the same time, I went, no, it was very gratifying to know that they were that much invested in the production.
You've just laid it out for us in this way that we can see. It's not just the themes, it's these characters.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, very much so. And one of the things we're doing with the production, I mean, it's very overtly theatrical. I mean, we're not making any pretense about the fact that we're doing a play, and we're doing a play in 2016, and when the audience comes into the theater, members of the company, the cast, actually, will be working the house as ushers, and ticket takers, and that sort of thing. We're essentially welcoming people to this community of Macomb and bringing them in and, you know, showing them all. I mean, the set is entirely see-through. I mean, it's a framework. You can see the backstage area. You can see the actors sitting in chairs waiting before they come on and develop their character as they walk into place. Again, like I say, it's something that I felt was vital to keep it contemporary and say, no, this is an archetype, and it's about now as much as it is about 1935, and hopefully it will always be relevant in our lives.
And key to this, and you mentioned the young people who were coming to see the production 20 years ago, is this young
girl. Oh, absolutely.
Did you find a scout?
Oh, yeah, and, you know, it was totally unexpected. I had been asked early on if we were going to, you know, throw out a broad net for children. And my first instinct was, well, I don't think we will because, you know, again, the play deals with a certain maturity, certainly in the language. And it's the language of the time. And I went, I'm not going to alter it or water it down. I want to, you know, stay true certainly to Harper Lee's intent as well as to the playwright who adapted it. But then all of a sudden this girl showed up, who I wasn't expecting, young girl. She's about 13 years old. Her name's Rihanna Lewis. She's a student at Wyoming Seminary. And she came in, and she had actually a fairly impressive resume of credits. She's done a lot of community work. And I went, okay, well, let's see what you have. She came in, she read, and I went, oh, my gosh, Scout just walked into the theater. Yeah, and it was like, it was amazing. She was wonderful, and she still continues to amaze me every night. I sometimes forget, and I talk to her like she's a seasoned professional, and I go, oh, wait, yeah, okay. And then I remember, oh, yes, well, in, you know, Wyoming Seminary, they're very demanding in terms of their academic standard there. So she is. She's having to keep up with all that homework. She's studying two languages while she's doing this play at night and trying to keep up with all her homework. She's doing an incredible job. She's really a gifted young lady, so I'm blessed to have her as that role in this show.
It can work on any level, but how wonderful to have a 13-year-old who has that depth.
Yeah, well, and, you know, that was the thing. When I did the production professionally 20 years ago, our scout was just a girl in her early 20s who happened to be very small and could play the role, but there was a maturity there. It was like, okay, and that was kind of nice to have, but this is so refreshing. You know, I mean, it just is for me to find a child who's that bright, who is that advanced in her thinking, and, you know, who can converse with a professional on that level. And she does, and there's no intimidation factor for her whatsoever. No, she's fantastic. I can't say enough good things about her.
You mentioned the language. What about your wanting us to be drawn into this time that it's not just then, but it's now, but perhaps there is a tension between that language and a certain sensibility of a time and now?
Sure, yeah. It's been, I will say that it's been quite an experience trying to find a way to deal with this issue. I mean, we've talked about it amongst the cast, and I would say we addressed it at the very first read-through, obviously, but it's still something we continue to discuss almost nightly, you know, in some ways. And it's obviously awkward, you know. I mean, it's really an unfortunate and ugly part of our history, yet it's also part of our history. We can't deny it, sweep it under the rug, and pretend it didn't exist. So that's kind of the awareness that students and community members in the show have now. And we've been very careful on the marketing of the show, certainly on any of the visual publicity that goes out, to say, look, this play contains hateful, racially insensitive language. So be aware. And some parents may not want their children exposed to that. And it was odd for me, again, having done the show 20 years ago, to think about it now and go, you know, actually, it was a problem then as well, but not as significant as it is today. I think today it's even more sensitive than it was 20 years ago, partly because people have forgotten, you know, many people have forgotten how common and prevalent that language was. And the odd thing is today now, I mean, we know the prevalence of the N-word, certainly in the show and novel, it's there. But even the term that's politer, you know, the Negro term, which gets used in the play as well, that was something that I went, oh yeah, that's an issue now that didn't used to be. And so we still have to discuss those things as well. But of course, the great thing about the novel as well as the play is this idea that, you know, you understand people for who they are, not by what labels are attached to them, but the fact that they're human beings. And all of us need to empathize with other human beings and look at things from their point of view. And when you do that, those labels fall away. They mean nothing anymore. And that's really, I think, to me, the larger message behind the show and the story anyway. And once people come to understand that, I think there's almost a healing that goes on about that language and having heard it or used it, whatever, that people go, yeah, that's right. What does it mean? It doesn't mean anything, really. Nor does white mean anything as a label or, you know, any of the other labels that we attach to human beings.
Well, in this instance, and you referred to the novel, this is a piece that we know from the novel, we know from the film,
yes,
we know from the play. What is the power of theater? And you're calling our attention to the power of theater,
right,
by the way you're staging,
yeah,
the piece. I would think that the impact and the healing potential might even be deeper because of the visceral nature of people hearing these words or watching this story unfold with living, breathing people in front of us.
Right, absolutely, yeah. And again, we're making every effort for our performers to interface with our audience as well. I mean, there's a lot of direct address to the audience within the show, as well as the pre-show where, like I say, actors are actually working front of house and bringing people in and giving them programs and helping them to their seats. Part of it is making them part of this community and understanding we all are. You know, we're part of a larger community at all times, not just Scranton, not just Pennsylvania, not just the United States of America, but on a global sense. We are part of this large community. And part of the choice to have the actors present, or ever present, as it were, on stage, is this idea of witnessing, which I think is extremely important, given the subject matter and its relevance to today. I mean, yeah, we need to be witnesses to not just our strengths, but also our weaknesses and the things we need to address. So that's where that idea more or less came from. But yeah, you're right. I think live theater has a power that, I mean, I still watch the film. I won't lie. I love it. It's wonderful. Gregory Peck was great. But in truth, when I look at the film over time, I go, this is a story that's a coming-of-age story. And that's really what the film was. But when I read the novel, I go, it's not the same. The novel's not just a coming-of-age story. It's a coming-of-age story for a people. It's a coming-of-age story for a culture. And I went, that's where the importance lies, and that's what we all need to do right now, I think, is grow up a little bit.
We hear the title so often that it goes in one ear and out, To Kill a Mockingbird. What have you come to 20 years ago with the title and now?
Yes. I mean, again, of course, the line in the novel as well as the play and the movie, killing a mockingbird is a sin because they don't do anything but sing their hearts out for us. And it's such a wonderful line. And it, you know, it still resonates. I mean, I think it always will, because that's what we need to understand about most people. I mean, whatever their problems may be, you know, and Harper Lee is so wonderful in terms of the story she constructed here, because you've got this awful woman, this Mrs. DeBose, who just screams at these children, and then you find out, well, she had a problem. And that's the thing, and it's through understanding that we go, oh, well, if we understood her problem, maybe she wouldn't have been mean, maybe she would have found a different way to deal with it, and maybe, you know, could have died peacefully, which ultimately she did, thanks to this young boy reading to her, reading out loud. And it was like, that's all it took. So, yeah, I mean, it's just such a rich tapestry of different angles on humanity and empathy, certainly. I mean, that's the thing that keeps surfacing all the time, is if you understand another person, you can, you know, again, find a way to work with them and find a way to appreciate them instead of despising them or taking a divisive approach toward them.
Do you have an impulse to say that seeing this would be important for us if communities all across the country could do a production of Mockingbird?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think it would be fantastic for people to see it live. And it is a much-done production, to be fair, as well. I mean, it is done across the country quite a bit. You know, just, what, 5-6 years ago, I believe, Montana Repertory had a very successful production touring all over the country. But they're not the only ones. I know that there have been productions in upstate New York, as well as productions in, certainly the Midwest. It's been very prevalent there as well. But yeah, I think that people could definitely benefit from seeing this story whenever and however often they chose to, because I discover something new in it every night.
As we said, you said you were the bad guy
yes.
20 years ago. What's coming out in your actor this time that might be different?
Oh, he's very different from me. I would say in some ways he's much more imposing than I was. He's certainly physically. Peter Howey is playing the role, and he's actually a member of the United States Navy, you know, and he's in great physical shape. He's a much more imposing Bobby, and I kind of liked that. You know, I mean, I was a little more wiry, and I was kind of the little man that Harper Lee described in the book when I approached it. And Peter is not that at all. And it did take a lot of discussion with him to go, you know, it's important for you to commit to that ugliness, to that hatred, to all of that loathing that he has, but also to understand that it comes from somewhere. You know, it's not out of the blue. It's not out of nowhere. You know, I think the publishing of Hillbilly Elegy was quite a thing in terms of understanding that particular culture and where it comes from and why. There are roots to that hatred. And again, I don't think anybody's reached out to try and bridge that gap and make that something that we can openly discuss in the political discourse right now. So it is something we need to address, just as we need to address all the other problems. But until we start with empathy, we're not going to begin to do that.
You're welcome to say where and when.
It will be at the Set La Verghetta Center for Performing Arts at Marywood University, October 7th and 8th, 7:30 performances. And we recommend people get there a little early because it is general admission, so it's not reserved seating in that sense. And people who want to reserve tickets can pay for them with credit card by going to our website, which is marywood.edu/tickets. And that's the best way to reserve tickets. And then if they have questions or other things about, you know, information they'd like about the show, they're welcome to give us a call at our box office information number, which is 570-348-6211, extension 6097.
Charles Gordon, associate professor and theater program director at Marywood University in Scranton, speaking about the upcoming production of To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee in a stage adaptation this Friday and Saturday, October 7th and 8th, at 7:30 each evening. They offer this caveat: the production contains hateful, racially sensitive language that may prove offensive to some viewers. For more information, on the web, marywood.edu, marywood.edu. That's To Kill a Mockingbird, Friday and Saturday, October 7th and 8th, at 7:30 each evening at the Seth Lavergetta Center for the Performing Arts on the Marywood University campus in Scranton. For more information, on the web, marywood.edu, marywood.edu.